Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solieri Report. Today we have a very distinguished guest, Dr. David Ray Griffin, who is a now retired professor of philosophy of religion and theology. He is the co-founder of the Center for Process Studies, a research center at the Claremont School of Theology, and has become one of the, certainly the most distinguished leader, publishing books on the September 11 attacks and really underscoring the lack of integrity to the official story and talking a lot about what the facts are, what we know. And he has a new book. It's called Bush and Cheney, How They Ruined America and the World. And it starts with 9/11, but it goes much more into the policies that 9/11 justified and why it's imperative to turn things around. So, Dr. Griffin, it's a pleasure to have you on the Solieri Report. And I just want to thank you so much for your extraordinary contribution to trying to turn America in a positive direction.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, I wanted to start, it's funny. I had this image of you as the bell struck on midnight in the beginning of the new century. It's January 1st, 2000. I dare say the one thing you didn't think was, okay, well, in the new century, I'm going to become a leader in exposing false flag attacks in America and stopping the neocon agenda for global domination.
So, thought didn't occur.
And I think one of the reasons I think you've been one of the most persuasive voices on 9/11 truth is, you come from a place of extraordinary integrity, but I don't think many people around you expected you to be doing this in the 21st century. So tell us how you became a leader in 9/11 truth, because it has to be a remarkable story.
You got a few hours? No. But basically, I hadn't paid any attention to about any question about 9/11. So I'm kind of a Johnny come lately. Other people were there, two or three years ahead of me. And I did have a guy come through the school and visited the School of Theology, and one of my students said, "You've got to listen to this guy. He says 9/11 is an inside job." And she says, "Well, would you listen to him?" And I said, "Well, okay, I'll listen to him." So I listened to him, and then I went home and checked around on the internet, and I found a bunch of websites. I even took the one he suggested, and I looked at it, and I thought, "No, there's nothing here." And so then several months later, another colleague sent me a website that was very, very factual. It just had kind of the history of what had happened here. And very quickly I saw, oh, this looks serious. So I started studying it. It just happened at the time the students had asked me to give a lecture on the Iraq War, which I just got started. And so I did it, but I focused on the 9/11 as the excuse for the war. And so I wrote up this kind of outline, and I thought, well, I've got the outline written now, so I might as well go ahead and publish it. So that'll take me about a week. And so I started, and it just went on and on and on, and pretty soon I had this book. Uh-huh. And one publisher that looked at it said, "Well, you ought to call it the new related to the Nazis taking over." And I said, "Well, no, Americans don't know about that, but we do know about Pearl Harbor." So that's where I came to the title, The New Pearl Harbor. And it amazingly really took off.
Yeah.
And you know, other people had written books about it, but nobody, no American had written a full-length book about this. And then I got, you know, one very popular, well-known person wrote a review. This was Rosemary Ruther. And so it just, it really took off. And so then, at that time, I wrote it and I said, well, you know, it looks like it's an inside job, but maybe the 9/11 Commission, which was just getting ready to put its report out, maybe they have answers to all of these questions that I raised in the book. So at that time, you could say, well, I wasn't definitely a conspiracy theorist. I was a conspiracy inquirer. Right. And then I, as soon as the book came out, I ran to the bookstore and got it and started reading it. And I thought, oh, my gosh, it's even worse than I expected, because every question that I dealt with, right, they either omitted that or distorted it. And so that became the title for my book, The 9/11 Commission Report, or Omissions and Distortions. So that's how I got started.
Well, I don't know if you know this. I was a founder of a group called Unanswered Questions. And our idea
was... Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, so our idea was, look, we don't have the powers of government or the resources to create an evidentiary trail, but what we can do is ask questions and collect the questions. And that group, which included Scoop Media New Zealand, incubated Paul Thompson's timeline and sort of supported him. And, of course, he put together the timeline, which was an amazing tool that helped people understand why the questions were so serious. And then the commission, you know, there was great hope if we took the questions to the commission.
That's what I was referring to when I said I found a really good website, and that was Paul Thompson's.
Yeah, it was amazing, remarkable researcher, remarkable job. And but then we kind of felt, you know, we were trying to hold the space until the big gun showed up, and then you and the architects and engineers and some other really serious intellectual capacity showed up, and we're like, phew!
But your organization was one of the ones that influenced me at the beginning.
Yeah, well, we were clear that we were in over our head in terms of trying to figure out what happened, but we really felt that if you just got the right questions asked and held government accountable, part of it was, you know, we had to hold government accountable to answer the questions, which was why the push for the commission. And of course, the families were very powerful, because the difference between this and a lot of false flag attacks is you had a lot of very powerful, intelligent, well-educated families who'd been harmed. So, yeah, and they were smart enough to know that the official story wasn't satisfying. Well, this book is very special. So tell us how you, because you've written several very successful books on 9/11, but tell us how you came to write Bush and Cheney, How They Ruined America and the World, and why you wrote it.
Okay, well, like you say, I had written almost a dozen books on this, and each one of them took it a step further, because when we would say something, then the defenders of the official story would come out with something else. And so, like debunking 9/11, I responded to four major defenses of the official story. And then when I got down to the New Pearl Harbor Revisited, I really laid out the whole case. And so the whole case, you know, I mean, with exaggeration, had been, we didn't need another book like that.
Right.
And, I mean, there are always new details, and the scientists keep coming up with new evidence that further disprove the official story and so on. But what I realized, the way I did this, I had actually virtually promised my wife I would not ever write another book on 9/11. and I mean, this is serious, serious
right.
stuff. And so about a year and a half ago, I started reading all these articles, which had, you know, for the most part were saying the world's been going to hell since, and then some people would say, since the attack on Iraq, and then others would say, well, since 9/11, and of course that's right. What I thought. And so I thought, well, if I could lay out just how much the world has gone to hell in so many areas, that might get, you know, the big people, and maybe to get somebody in the mainstream press to get on this and say, look, you know, we've got all sorts of reasons not to support a conspiracy theory, but here things are getting so serious that we're not only going to destroy America, we're going to destroy the whole world, and so maybe we will risk our reputations to tell the truth. Right. And so that was the first part of the book, of course, and gave all of those 10 major reasons. And then I thought, well, if people read that and then thought, well, this guy Griffin, he's a conspiracy theorist, so who can believe him? But you know what he says in those first 10 chapters, that's all good stuff. It's all right. And shows good research and all that. So my naive idea would be that then they might say, well, okay, let's go ahead and read, see what he has to say about 9/11. And right. Then on that part of the book, I saw that there are just so many arguments, you know, the reasons to distrust or reject the official story. We're talking about 60, 70, 80, 200 reasons, you know, and who can keep track of that? And somebody just coming into this cold say, oh, that's just overwhelming, I can't get into this. I've had people tell me that. And so I thought, well, let's really simplify it, get it down to the most obvious thing that's false, which is that the official story is based on miracles. And using miracles, yeah, in David Hume's sense, things that simply can't be true.
Yeah, better a conspiracy theorist than a miracle theorist.
That's right.
Right.
So I thought, well, you know, all these people, that quite a few of them would accuse us of being anti-scientific. And so I said, there's nothing more unscientific than endorsing miracles. And if I could talk to one of these people, I'd say, well, look, do you believe in miracles? Of course not. Well, right. What about this? How could this have happened without a miracle? Well, let's talk about something else. So that's my strategy, that they would say, well, no, I can't deny. You know, we got the facts. We got sort of nobody can doubt the fact that the World Trade Center 7 came down for almost 2.5 seconds in absolute free fall. And if right. people don't know what that means that, like with Building 7, you've got 82 steel columns holding the building up. And it came down in free fall, and absolutely horizontal line, roof line. So that means all 82 columns had to come down simultaneously. And so the official story that it came down because of fire. There's no way that fire, first of all, it couldn't bring it down at all.
Right.
But it certainly could not have brought down everything simultaneously. So that's the strategy. If they could just look at those 15 miracles and say, okay, we can't buy those, so what do we do? And, of course, the normal response is going to be, well, I'm going to deal with something else because I'll lose my job if I tell the truth here.
Right.
So then my next strategy is to say, if that's true, you know, if Rachel Maddow came out on this, you know, which is she's one of the ones smart enough to see this and has a huge audience, and but even she would be fired.
Right.
But what if she and 20 other major commentators and you know, let's get 50 really, really highly respected people to say it. Well, then they couldn't go firing all of those just because of they suddenly all inexplicably became 9/11 conspiracy theorists.
Right.
So that's the hope, but of course it's a long shot, but it seemed like worth a try.
Well, another thing I found very compelling about the book, I once wrote an article that got into the black budget, and I explained that you have all these different symptoms of the black budget, whether it's narcotic trafficking in neighborhood or false flags or this or that, and everybody's sort of organizing and coming at it by fighting the symptoms instead of sitting down and saying, you know, it's a relatively small group of people doing all of this, and you know, we've all experienced a different symptom, but the reality is all of our relatives are being poisoned or killed, you know, by a relatively small group of people. If you look at who is doing this, I used to have a friend who'd walk around saying, who's doing this? Who is this? And, and I think you started off with who, okay, who's doing this? Let's look at who the neocons are. Let's look at Bush. Let's look at Cheney. Let's look at their liability and accountability for what happened, whether it's 9/11 or the events thereafter, the shredding of the Constitution. And that's the question. You know, if we're going to hold people accountable, we've got to ask the who question. And you started with the who question, which I like tremendously, because, you know, without accountability, there are no real changes coming. One of the chapters, which I thought was remarkable, was on the shredding of the Constitution. And you do a great job of explaining how 9/11 was used to basically compromise different aspects of our compliance with the Constitution. I'd love it if you could just walk us through some of those.
Yes. You know, Bush and Cheney are in the title, but the book is really about Cheneyism. Because it continued sort of half-heartedly with Obama, full-heartedly with Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And so when I wrote the book, of course, I assumed that Hillary would become the next president. So I spent a lot of time showing just how disastrous she has been. One good book about Hillary was called The Queen of Chaos, and everything she touched, you know, ended up in chaos.
Right.
Most obviously, of course, the
Libya,
and she was hot on the trail on Syria, so she was behind, and there was and they pretty much said that when she became president, she would go back to wiping out Assad and taking over Syria. So the book is really about Cheneyism, and each of these chapters deals with something that Cheney was responsible for. So most people they realize he was a bad guy and did some bad things, in particular the attack on Iraq, but they don't realize that he was behind all these other things.
Right.
And most clearly, one might say, the destruction of the Constitution, because Cheney had always been an absolutist who believed that the power of the president dealing with so-called national defense is unlimited. And he can contradict Congress, and anything he does, anything the president decides, is law and cannot be questioned even by the Supreme Court. So that's the background. And so then you go through the various parts of the Constitution, and of course central to the Constitution is the Bill of Rights. And I focus primarily on the amendment, First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, and Fifth Amendment.
And one of the things I think you make clear, and it's in that chapter and another one with the description, the drone program, they've created a machinery where the executive branch can basically go to war and occupy. I mean, so we've moved military all around the world. Basically go to war and occupy anywhere around the world, and Congress is not required to say Bo Peep about it. In fact, Senator Paul just tried to rescind that authority, and the Senate wouldn't support him. So, but we're also talking about a parallel structure where the president and the executive branch can assassinate a U.S. citizen or a global citizen anywhere, anytime, with no transparency or due process.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially,
okay,
we're talking about a killing machine outside the law.
That's right. So there are two. Let's deal with these two issues in turn. Is the assassinations, but let's deal first with the power of the president. Now, this was not new. It goes way back, where certainly Nixon had this view of the president. He said, you know, if the president does it, it's not illegal. So it's his view that a president could do anything with regard to war. Well, Congress stopped that in the Frank Church hearings. And so we brought back somewhat of the Constitution, thanks to the French Frank Church hearings. And but now when Cheney came on, and of course all the presidents have been acting as if they had the right, but at least they would take the, you know, go through the motions of agreeing with the Constitution that only the Congress can start a war. But Cheney, more clearly even than Nixon, said you don't even have to go to the Constitution to the Congress. It's all in his. And so we're back to having a king. And that is the whole point of the American Constitution, is to make sure that we never have a king where the king can determine everything. Cass Sunstein, he's not one of my favorite guys, but he made a good observation about John Yoo, said that his task, what Cheney gave Yoo, was to create a kind of 9/11 constitution. And by that, of course, he meant one in which the president has unlimited power.
Right. The Fourth Amendment, so the right of people to be secure in their home, etc. One of the major compromises of the Constitution we saw was the Bush administration turn over or authorize the NSA to do essentially complete surveillance. And one of the things we know as a result of Bill Binney and Kirk Webby and Tom Drake's work, which has been phenomenal, is that there was a way to achieve all of the national security objectives, number one, without invasive surveillance of Americans, and number two, without turning the entire infrastructure over to private contractors who are doing who knows what with the data. So it's been proved that this was absolutely, you know, it was not necessary to compromise the Fourth Amendment to achieve the national security result, let alone put private contractors in charge. So and yet they've done it, and it seems, you know, every effort, there was an effort by the part of the Republican group in Congress to turn that around, and that's when you had, you know, the congressman shot during the baseball practice. He was a part of that group, and I'm assuming that could have been related. So,
yeah, I have no idea. Yeah,
yeah.
This is a long, long story. But again, Cheney was central. He turned to Michael Hayden, who was the director of the NSA at the time, and he said, "What if the NSA were unleashed?" By that, he meant didn't have to obey any congressional laws whatsoever. And so then Cheney and his attorney, David Addington, worked out this surveillance program, which came to be known as just the program. And then Snowden, what he became so well known for was he pointed out all the violations that the program, all the ways in which the program violated the Fourth Amendment. There was this dramatic, standoff between the president and the Justice Department,
right.
And of course, Comey had just come into the Justice Department then. Was given a hand in this, and they all were ready to resign in protest about this unless it was changed, and Bush did change it, but it turned out that none of that really made any difference, that what they wanted, what Cheney wanted, ended up being the effective law. And so, you know, many, many people commenting on this. Peter Van Buren is one of my favorites, and he said the Fourth Amendment has, by any practical definition, been done away with. And Snowden said the same thing. He said that the NSA documents and all that were written as if the Fourth Amendment no longer exists.
Right. Right. Well, I say it does exist, so I haven't given up yet. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. What this means is, of course, if somebody really wanted to push the issue, and so if you had a president, just imagine that, you know, we might have a president who didn't know very much and wasn't very concerned with the Constitution and legality, and they decided, well, let's go in and see what Cheney has accomplished here and how much we can just put ourselves in absolute control. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, you know, Trump has not done this, and for all sorts of reasons we don't know, but if he gets impeached, I'm much more nervous about the fact that that Pence, who's a much more organized fellow, might carry through what could be done.
Right. I wanted to bring up the appropriation clause because one of my interests in 9/11, I had been working with a reporter at Insight Magazine. Insight Magazine, whenever they had a new magazine, it would come out every week, would deliver it to every congressman's office, every senator's office. So everybody in Congress, both staff and principals, you know, would get a copy. So it had a very good circulation in Washington. And we had been working on a story about money that had gone missing. Starting in fiscal 1998, massive amounts of money started going missing from HUD and DOD, and actually NASA as well, some of the other agencies. And I started to track the story in 1998 and started working with this reporter in 2000. And we had finally built up, she had done a series of great articles, and then we were finally building up to a huge cover story on the missing money that was supposed to come out on September 15th. So it was going to hit every congressional desk on September 15th. And the day before 9/11, on Monday, Rumsfeld came out and had a press conference confessing that $2.3 trillion had missing. In fact, at that time it was $4 trillion, but he only did 1 year. And I remember calling her and saying, you know, nothing can stop this story from going mainstream now. You know, thinking, okay, this is going to follow up on September 15th. Well, of course, 9/11 happened the next day. And then Congress was off to the races, you know, increasing appropriations by $48 billion. And that story, you know, got postponed to October and then got buried. Now, here's what's interesting. I've been working with a professor from Michigan State University, who, in fact, we're going to have on next week on the Salieri Report. We're now up to $18 trillion of undocumentable adjustments. And what's interesting is if you look at 9/11 was instrumental in not only getting a lot of that $4 trillion covered up and sort of off the agenda. You know, if you look at the different sort of securities operations that were destroyed or the offices at the Pentagon that were destroyed, you know, it was used as an excuse for many years not to produce audited financial statements as required by law. But now we're up to $18 trillion of undocumentable adjustments. In 2015 alone, DOD had $6.5 trillion. And so you've seen two things happen. The four trillion missing money got buried, which is clearly a violation of the appropriations law. And then despite not being in compliance with the appropriations clause of the Constitution, you know, the money spending for the national security state has exploded since then. The private contractors and the stock market, you know, profits have exploded from then. And now we're up to $18 trillion of undocumentable adjustments and no transparency, no audited financial statements. So complete violation of both sections of the appropriation clause. And, you know, I've always believed that the money was a significant part of 9/11. Part of it was, you know, because I was focused on that and then saw how 9/11 was used to basically not only cover it up, but keep the game going. And frankly, I think they moved a lot of the black budget on budget because they were able to get away with so much just ignoring the financial management laws that federal agencies are subject to.
Yeah, this is a huge dimension of this, which I have not devoted enough attention to. But as a general statement, I would say, you know, when you're dealing with these questions, there's always, you know, a political scientist raise, well, what's the biggest issue? Is it money or is it power? And I think
it's power.
Well, I think it's both. I think with Cheney himself, the main thing was power. He's this goal of you know, that was announced by the for the New American Century, the idea of creating a completely unitary state where we would be in control of the whole planet, have all the planet's resources under our control, and have no governments that opposed us. That was his dream,
right?
And sometimes called Cheney's dream. Now, he was not indifferent to money, but for other people, I think the money is the biggest issue. So within the organization and the setting up of the 9/11 attacks, I think that money and power were just about equal in what they hoped to achieve.
Right. To me, the money, I think what Cheney and his group believe is for them to achieve Cheney's dream, they need non-transparent, open-ended funding. In other words, they need to be able to spend whatever they want, whenever they want. They need to be able to spend it, you know, they need to source it through the federal credit mechanism, so it's taxpayer government money, and they need to source it from that mechanism, but they need to be able to spend it outside the law, and they need to be able to create assets that then can be controlled by private corporations underneath their wings. So what they want to be able to do is have the taxpayer create the most powerful technology in the world, but they want to be able to shelter that technology behind private corporations. So an independent financing mechanism, which is completely out of your control and is basically infinite, is the source of financing the different steps you need to create that power. So, you know, to me, the money issue is a subset of political power. And it's just sort of, you know, it's you have a car, you need to put gas in the tank to get you where you want to go. But your goal is not to accumulate as much gas as possible. Your goal is simply to, you know, drive your car to where you want to go. So I don't think, I'm with you, I don't think Cheney cares that much about money. It's simply a tool that he needs to put in the car to make it go where he wants, which is, I agree with you, is global domination.
Yeah, that's what most Americans, you know, yet do not realize. It's more and more people are seeing this, but still, you know, it does not make the New York Times front page. In fact, you never even get it mentioned right. that's the goal. The New York Times will never even mention that, well, of course, to achieve these things, we have to violate international law. They act as if international law does not exist, except when we want to use international law to bash somebody else, whether in North Korea or Iran or whomever.
Well, the one thing that I can contribute on this is I worked in the first Bush administration for a group of, I would describe them as neocons. And the thing that was interesting to me, I'll tell you two stories that describe it. The first one was we had a secretary who would get very emotional and used to have sort of psychotic episodes. And at one point, I was meeting with him and 10 regional administrators, and one of the regional administrators had gotten a court decision and had proceeded to implement something in a program. And the secretary started screaming at him, and he said, "But Mr. Secretary, I had to, it's the law." And the secretary just started absolutely, you know, bright red face, screaming at the top of his lungs, the law, I don't have to obey the law, I report to a higher moral authority. You know, and he was incensed that anybody would be bothered to think that they were subject to stupid things like court decisions. Then another situation, we had a decision on a program, and the secretary made a decision to do something that was going to lose us $1 billion and violate massive number of private contracts that the agency had with different mortgage providers. It was just a complete abrogation of contract, and one that was going to destroy lots of businesses or cause major losses. And I was arguing there was a way that we could shut down the program that would be far less harmful both to the taxpayers and the private businesses and would respect the contracts. But they didn't think it would get them as big a headline as a big abrupt thing that would lose us $1 billion. Anyway, the general counsel, who was very neoconish, said, he kept using the F word. He kept saying, F them, they're all sewer rats. Who cares what contracts they have? By the time they win in court, we'll be gone. And yeah. Basically what he's saying is, you know, we have no obligation to obey the law. The law is irrelevant. It's not important. And what you saw when you worked with these folks is that they were basically, you know, they were like on a drunk. Leonard Cohen has a wonderful song where he says, "We were blinded by the beauty of our weapons." But they basically see themselves as above the law, as simply re-engineering and reorganizing history. And they have this intuition that if you just create chaos, everything will intuitively reorganize and come back. And you have a wonderful chapter in the book where you describe literally the danger of a nuclear ecological holocaust from their shenanigans. You know, and the reality is, if you've ever been upfront and personal with these folks, they're nuts enough to do it. And, you know, the you know, yes, 9/11 was an inside job, but if you look at what it's leading to, it's leading to a planetary inside job, and the human race may not survive that next inside job, or that creeping inside job.
And on both of those issues, again, Cheney was central to Cheney hated anything to do with ecology, saving the planet, environment, all of that. I mean, he just hated it. And he did everything he could to make sure the money got spent on military matters rather than that. Because if you remember, yeah, I'm sure you do, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the Americans, you know, well-meaning Americans were so excited because, look, we're going to have such a great peace dividend. All the money we've been spending on the military, those billions of dollars, now we can use it for the environment and health, education, and so on. And Cheney deliberately started wars to make sure that couldn't happen.
Right.
So he is behind that, and then likewise with regard to our confrontation with Russia, he was behind that, and he had no concern that, you know, they might get to the point where they were not going to take it anymore. And of course, we're dealing with, yeah, go ahead.
The one thing I would say is, Cheney, if you look at what Cheney has been implementing for many, many decades, in my experience, he's always had the full support of the bankers. So,
absolutely.
You know, the bankers want one world government. No one can go into the executive branch and do these kinds of things without the, you know, without the New York Fed member banks and their owners being in full support. So, you know, if Cheney's doing anything, he's fronting for quote unquote a new world order. You know, it's not just Cheney alone. I think the bankers really see this. They think unless they establish a unipolar empire globally now, they're not going to make it.
Well, Cheney is clearly the front for this desire,
right.
But he's a very passionate front.
He's a very effective front for a psychopathy.
Yeah.
Well, I agree. Cheney's I've written a couple pieces and tried to focus people on how instrumental Cheney has been to all of this, and so I really appreciate this effort. I got a call from somebody today who reminded me that she had spent $800 long ago on a banner that said "Impeach Cheney first." So let's talk about one of the things I loved in this book was your description of the extraordinary credentials of many, many very accomplished and capable leaders who've come out saying 9/11 was an inside job or the official story is all bunk. Maybe if you could tell us a little bit about the accumulation of extraordinary talent behind 9/11 truth.
Yeah, it's something that the press goes to extremes to make it seem like truthers, which is their term.
Right.
Which is funny that's become a derogatory term. You've got truthers or you've got liars, and they seem to prefer the liars. It's just amazing that an organization is ridiculed because it's trying to find the truth. In any case, they these stories, the press comes out and say, well, these guys, these 9/11 conspiracists, they don't really know anything, and so they're making all these declarations, and they really don't know anything. They don't know the military thing. They don't know the economy. They don't know this or that, and they don't know politics and so on. And they never mention that the 9/11 Truth organization is composed of all sorts of organizations of professionals. Right. So you've got professional, some of the even in the health, some of the leading people in the health system have endorsed this, and then likewise with they've got 9/11. Of course, a big one is architects and engineers,
right,
for 9/11 Truth, which Richard Gage started with a member of. Membership of one himself, and now it has around 3,000. And this means people, professionals who have degrees or licenses or whatever, who were willing to sign document, sign the petition, saying that the official story is false, cannot possibly be true.
Right.
This means that. They risk losing jobs when people say, well,
right,
I'm not going to give this job to one of these damn truthers.
Right.
And these people went ahead and signed it in spite of that danger.
Right.
And then we have 9/11 political leaders, religious leaders, firefighters, and on down the list, and if people will look at the list, they see, and I laid this out in one of my earlier books called, I'm blanking here, Conspiracy, it'll come to me here directly, but let's not try to find it here, my memory has gotten so bad, but... That in the last part of this book, I give a abbreviated version of that, and I think one would say most. I'm glad you were very impressed by that, because it's something that most people don't know when they say truthers. Nobody thinks of people who were leading figures in.
I do, just because I've had experience. Yeah, I've had so much experience with it. I mean, early on, but I was, when you look at the group you're describing, or you look at the architects and engineers, this new video Experts Speak Out, which we've posted in the commentary for this Larry report, the number of people who have fearlessly and courageously stepped up is just amazing.
Yeah, and so this is, again, the strategy in my book was hoping that people would look at the first part of the book and see that it's, done well enough, and the issues we're talking about are serious enough,
right,
that they'd be willing to at least look at the evidence. I mean, the CIA did such an effective job of trashing our organization, so that they'll talk about birthers and truthers in the same breath, as
right,
if they're basically the same. They just have a hunch; they don't have any evidence, and so on. Well, that's true about the birthers, but it's exactly not true about the truthers, and yet they. They create this impression that it's all the same sort of conspiracy, and that's what they generally mean when they say conspiracy theory. They mean, first of all, you're opposing the government, and secondly, You're accusing the government of having done something wrong, and then doing it in such a way that
right.
it's going to harm the country, and so on, and so that, and that they have no evidence whatsoever. So it would be just a waste of time to read a book dealing with 9/11. So I deliberately did not put 9/11 in the title
in
of
the
my
title.
Book, hoping that some people might start reading the book and realize it's a pretty good book before they realize that it's a 9/11 book.
Right. Well, I think it's a very clever strategy, because the important thing, 9/11 is not the core issue here. The core issue is, you know, how is America governed and how is it going to be governed? And you have a group of people whose plan is to tear up the Constitution and affect a global totalitarian governance structure. And the reality is, you know, they can't do that inside the law, and it's our job to stop them. So let me turn to what should we do? We get the book, we read it. Now we've read it, we agree. What should we do? How do we start to either help this knowledge spread or achieve accountability and get these policies turned around?
Well, of course, that's the most difficult question, and I'm certainly not one with a fount of wisdom about this, but the first thing I would say is just courage. You know, there are all sorts of people in the government, in the media, who have enormous possible influence if they just had the courage to come out and speak about it. If, you know, so let's get some people in the media. They'd say, well, look, I couldn't do that. I'll lose my job. Well, let's kind of organize. And if we get, you know, 40 of the top correspondents, journalists in America to come out with a statement like this and say, look, we want to make this statement. And they're going to say, well, we're going to fire you. You're going to fire all 40 or 50 of us simultaneously. And why are you going to do that? You're going to have to reveal to the public that you fired us because we wanted to speak about 9/11 truth. They're not going to want to do that. So I think there are things we could do like that, people could do that could make a difference.
I also think frankly, if people would stop listening to people who don't, I mean, why are we listening to anybody who refuse, you know, who's censoring this story? So I had, one of the reasons I now publish this Lear report is in the Bush administration, and then when my company was working as a contractor in the Clinton administration, I had experiences, one with the New York Times and one with the Wall Street Journal, where they were just lying and breaking the law. They were,
oh sure,
they were the most unethical, you know, they were like criminal enterprises. And after I saw it, I said, you know, I want nothing ever to do with these folks again. Why is anybody watching? Why does anybody believe a word they? I don't believe a word they say. You know, I'll believe they. You know, if they say soybean futures are up, I'll believe them. But if they say this happened in Washington, I'm, you know, I just assume, okay, well, so what? That's why I love to follow the money, because the money, you know, the government can't say, oh, you know, something, we're going to spend $1 trillion illegally and refuse to disclose what we're doing with your money. That's very hard to pull off.
Yeah, but you've got, you know, maybe 1% of the people in the country, or at most 5%, who feel that strongly about it.
Right.
So they're going to get away with it, as they know. You know, they need their 60 or 70%, and they've got that, and it's pretty hard to buck against this. So I hope that some really smart people about strategy will read my book and then say, okay, now what could we do about this? because we're threatening not only to destroy our country, but to destroy our civilization, to destroy the human race. And wouldn't it be worth taking a few risks to do this?
Well, I think you've accomplished it. I think you've made a very powerful argument as to why it definitely is worth everybody's while to pitch in. And of course, if everybody just does what they can do, a mighty army arises. I mean, it's, if you look at the group of people doing it, it's a relatively small group. And there are plenty of us. And I just think what you and the other people who've been leading this effort have done, have accomplished, proves, you know, that a remarkably small group of people can do an amazing thing, you know, if they all just do what they can do.
Yeah, that's true on one side, but on the other side is the CIA, and the CIA has control of most, I don't know whether it's all, but most of the mainstream media, and so they simply can't publish things that the CIA says you cannot publish. So we're in a very, very difficult situation. By the way, the book I was trying to think of was Cognitive Infiltration, which dealt with Cass Sunstein, who became then the president, Obama's guy in charge of, you know, such questions, how the administration going to deal with questions like this. And, you know, he wrote this amazing article, he and a Harvard colleague, saying that, you know, we, with 9/11, we really can't deal with it head on. We can't just say, well, look, here are the facts, and so people shouldn't believe it because of A, B, C, D, these are all ridiculous things when we can prove it. They know they can't do that, so they go this other way and say, we're going to infiltrate these various 9/11 organizations and destroy them from within. So it returns back to previous FBI program of doing this, in which the government had declared we would never do such a thing again. And here he was, Sunstein, advocating publicly that we do this.
Right. It's COINTELPRO. Yeah. I've always thought Cass Sunstein always impressed me as arguably one of the most intellectually bankrupt people in the country.
Yeah, and but he's been, you know, he's been quoted as being, you know, the one of the leaders. In fact, some people said the leading intellect within the judiciary. And so either he's not as smart as they say, or else he uses it for very perverse reasons.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Okay, well, tell us what's up for you next. Have you been speaking? Tell us, are you going to continue to promote the book? Tell us what's next for Dr. Griffin.
Yeah, I don't go out anymore. There's this thing called age, and and then I have some special problems other than just age, and so I don't do any speaking anymore. And for a while, I had cut back on doing any interviews because of one of my problems. But I finally got to the point where I could do it adequately. I'm not as good at doing these interviews as before, but I think I do it adequately. So I'm happy now to get interviews and do it. But I'm going to try to deal with this, what I suggested at the beginning, to try to find somebody, some organization who would take the lead in trying to convince a group of highly respectable people to take the lead on saying we're at a point where we have to not worry anymore about our reputations. We've got to worry about the planet.
Well, that would be wonderful if you can accomplish that, because I think that, you know, long ago, I don't know if you remember, Steve Diamond got 100 people to sign a statement. And when Van Jones was thrown out of the administration, he reneged on his signature, and Paul Hawken and a group of people, you know, the scared guys all reneged on their signature. But it was very effective when it came out. And if you could do the same thing with a group of journalists, I think that would be very effective. You know, the more you communicate the quality of the credentials of the people, you know, one of the most heartwarming things, I drive around America a lot. One of the most heartwarming things you see, when, especially in the West, is you'll drive past these ranches that have big signs up on the highway saying 9/11 was an inside job. And of course, the ranchers own the land, you know, no one can make them take down the, so you have all these homegrown billboards just announcing as you drive around the country. And you know those ranchers are, it's fearless of them to do it. So I think the more people who come out and make that statement, you know, the better off and the faster we can turn these things around. And my big thing is that Cheney and his group have been able to erode the Constitution, but they haven't been able to tear it up. And there's a push underway now to get the states to approve a constitutional convention. And if they get their way, it can get torn up. So these guys haven't given up. They're going for the full Monty here. And I think your work is going to be very helpful in making sure that doesn't happen. So on behalf of everybody, you know, whether in the planet or the country, Dr. Griffin, I can't thank you enough for your work. Your contribution has been absolutely remarkable. You may not understand what a powerful impact you've had, but you did become the 21st century leader in truth. So,
well, thank you very much. It's been great talking with you.
Anything else you want to add before we close?
I don't think so. One thing I would say, you know, lots of people are buying my book, but hardly anybody is writing reviews on Amazon. And I used to get, you know, 40, 50 or 100 or 200 or 300 reviews, and now I've just got a handful. So some of your readers will not only get the book, but then write reviews. That would be helpful.
Okay, well, I'll go to Amazon today and write a review. And I invite all of our subscribers to do the same. Dr. Griffin, you have a wonderful day. And again, thank you for the interview, and thank you for the book, and thank you for everything you're doing for all of us.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.